Welcome to My Life as a Landlord, where we educate curious U.S. and Canadian landlords, answer rental questions, and clear up confusions about all things housing. If you're looking for some landlord education, interesting guests, and awkward conversations, you've come to the right show. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Salisbury. This is My Life as a Landlord. Welcome to it.
Hello there. Thanks for joining me. I am Dr. Jen. Thanks so much for joining me today. I am so excited for you to learn today from our incredible guest. I have on the show today one of the most accomplished folks that I have ever met, and I'm so happy to say he's been at my house for dinner. Yay. He's based in Nashville, Tennessee, and is an award-winning wealth advisor, attorney, and public education advocate. I'm just bragging on you a bit here. He is the founder and executive director of the American Public Education Foundation, which supports high-quality public education, including financial literacy and workforce development, which makes sense. I know him through his work with Maui United Way. And by the way, I didn't list all of his accolades because they are a lot. So I'm just going to hit the high points there. But one of the most humble yet accomplished people I know is with me today. Welcome, David Pickler. Oh, don't shake your head.
Oh, I'll just add just say, I'm just a guy.
You're just a guy. Well, you're a busy guy. Thanks for joining us today. I every time I talk to you, I always learn something. And today's topic is the U.S. economic projections for 2024. Lots of stuff happening. Fill us in. Where do we go from here?
Wow, Jen. First of all, I am so honored to be on your podcast. When we had the opportunity to be at your beautiful home with your great husband and just your great property, we just had an amazing time. And so excited to be here. But yeah, there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
we live in a world and a society that's really all about exponential change. And, you know, we've all been through so much here over the course of the past 4 years with the pandemic and all the aftermath of that. You know, it's been a world that's really been kind of thrown on its ear a little bit. It's been a time of great distortion. And when I think about all things that have happened, that it really can all be traced back to the pandemic, to COVID. Because, you know, when we had so many people that literally were thrown out of work because of the decision by our government to shut the world down, a decision that certainly could be largely debated, and then decision by the government to literally flood the world with dollar bills, that certainly there was a need for relief. There was a need for help for people, for unemployment benefits and for stimulus and whatever. But a lot of those needs were created because the government said, you know what, our reaction to this healthcare disaster was to create an economic disaster of literally biblical proportions. And so when they sent everyone home and they said, we've got to send the money with you, what they also did were sow the seeds of a level of inflation that we had not seen in 40 years. And so while, you know, we saw the economy begin to recover, then we saw that really by the beginning of 2022, that inflation was beginning to take hold. And as a result, we saw at one time at the beginning of 2023, where inflation was heading towards double digit levels. And any of us knows, if you've been to the grocery store, if you've been to the gas tank, that in many cases, the numbers were far in excess of 10%. And so as that began to unfold, then we do have this institution in America called the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is basically an organization that was created over 100 years ago to create more stability in our economy. They really have two goals, two mandates. One is full employment, to try to make sure that everyone who wants a job can find a job. And then the other is price stability. In other words, low inflation. And these are, it's a balancing act, Jen, you know, because the things that you do to try to encourage people to build, to grow, to expand, to hire more people is often involving having lower interest rates. The things that you need to do sometimes to try to bring inflation under control, which is what the Fed had to do in 2022, was actually the opposite of where you had to raise interest rates. And so the Fed has this very unique juggling act of trying to go out there and find a way to be able to address a serious problem, but yet at the same point, not throw the economy, which is already struggling, into a tailspin, into what we call a recession. So what we saw happening was coming into 2022, the Federal Reserve had interest rates at around 0%. Money was free. And it was very easily accessible because we were trying to encourage businesses to come back. We were trying to encourage people to get jobs, to hire more people. But as a result of this flood of money that was out there and this inflation that was beginning to take hold, the Federal Reserve had to take action and very strong action. And so what they began was a process that began in March of 2022, where they took interest rates from effectively zero. And over the next really year and a half, they raised rates 22 times. And they raised rates from zero all the way to nearly 5.5%. So when the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, what they're raising is short-term rates. The rates that you see often at the bank, you know, short-term deposits. And when they do that, as they're raising rates, they're doing it for the purpose of trying to slow down the economy. Mm-hmm. Because what they're trying to do is to try to find a way to get inflation under control. And so beginning in March of 2022, and really through about September of last year, September 2023, as I said, they raised rates from zero to over nearly 5.5%. Now, while that was going on, then we still had an economy that was trying to recover. We still were trying to get our economy back, get people back to work. And so it was a unique situation in the fact that we had, on the one hand, a desire to try to get inflation under control, and on the other, a desire to continue to have people gainfully employed. And so we use as a measure of full employment a figure of 4%. And you might say, well, why wouldn't it be 0%? Don't we want everybody to have a job? But the reality is we always have a certain percentage of our population that's moving from job to job, career to career. They're, you know, they're going through transition in their lives. And so we've always looked at 4% as kind of that measure of full employment. And so what we wanted to do was to try to really do three things all at once: to get inflation under control, to keep unemployment low, as much as we possibly could, and, oh, by the way, try to avoid sending the entire economy into a recession when everything starts going down. And interestingly enough, so far, as of this point today, we have done all three. It is pretty amazing. Over the course of the past 6 months especially, we have begun to see inflation really begin to trend downward. A year ago, inflation was over 9%. Now it's around 3%. A year ago, and actually as late as October of last year, mortgage rates, you guys deal with real estate all the time. Mortgage rates were nearly 8% in October of 2023. Just yesterday, our most recent report showed mortgage rates down to around 6.78%. Significant decline. And, oh, by the way, our economy is still growing. And so what we're finally beginning to say, that after 4 years after COVID, that a lot of the things that distorted the mindset and the structure of our economy are really coming back to normal. And we're moving back into a period of normalization that should set the stage for a very strong and hopefully disinflationary environment going forward. So I'm very, very excited about what may be happening there.
Oh my goodness, so much going on, and it's changing so fast. Exponential change. I completely agree. Now, you and I both know we've got elections coming up this year. How do you think the elections are going to throw a curveball in there?
Oh, my goodness. can we say chaos?
Yes.
You know, we're it appears at this point that we are heading for a rematch. It does appear that it's going to be Donald Trump versus Joe Biden. But we also are looking at the possibility of a Robert Kennedy Jr. We're looking at the possibility of a Liz Cheney. And as a result, I think that anything could happen. Will Donald Trump be convicted in some of these trials? Right. Will he actually still be eligible to run if he's convicted in the January 6th trials and thus found guilty of an insurrection? That's an issue. Will there be a health issue involving Joe Biden? What will be the impact of these third party candidates? And where will we be as a government at that point? And so right now, the, you know, elections always have consequences. And certainly we can see where in some circumstances that the outcome is so uncertain or the process so unclear that it can create a lot of instability and vulnerability in the market. Let's use example for 2020. In the year 2020, which was the first incarnation of Biden versus Trump, then there was a tremendous amount of angst and uncertainty about what, you know, would the results be something the American people would accept? Mm-hmm. You know, would there be great controversy over that election? And so the markets hate uncertainty. More than anything else, markets hate uncertainty. And we were given uncertainty by the bushel basket in 2020. And so we saw a lot of fluctuation, a lot of what they call volatility, where the markets were swinging all over the board in September and October leading up to the election. And certainly we saw that volatility continue well after the election because of the fact that we didn't know exactly who was going to be our winner, who was going to be our loser in that election, until we finally did achieve that degree of certainty that wasn't fully removed until Joe Biden took the oath of office on January 20th. This year, because of that history and because of the incredible amount of political polarization that exists here in this country, then I think the opportunity for that kind of uncertainty, that kind of distrust of the process, is at an even higher level. And I know that the things that we're looking at for our clients, we're going to be a lot more cautious heading into that September-October time period. We certainly will have learned the lessons of 2020 and very likely maybe taking a much more defensive, much more conservative posture to get through this election. But this election will be so incredibly important because of the fact that we have major issues in this country that have got to be addressed over the next 10 years. The current budget estimates and the current forecast show that Social Security and the Social Security Trust Fund may run out of money by the year 2033, that Medicare and Medicaid could very well be on the financial ropes in the early part of the next decade. We have major infrastructure issues, major entitlement issues that really help weave the fabric of our society that could run out of money in the next 10 years. We have a government that's already spending money like a bunch of drunken sailors. And with coming off a year with over a $1.7 trillion deficit and a level of spending that is so out of sync with the level of revenue, it's unsustainable. It's unaccountable. And quite frankly, it's astonishing of what it does. And it can lead this country to financial ruin. It could even lead to the eventual loss of what we call our reserve currency status, where we're seen as literally, you know, the baseline currency for all the operations of global economics. So we're in a situation where this election, not only do we need to get it right and elect, hopefully, you know, someone who's going to be our president, serve, you know, without major chaos leading to the inauguration, but we need to elect a Congress, a Senate, you know, a president who can be focused on solving problems, because we have some major issues that we've got to address. We have all of the tax code changes that were passed in 2017 by then President Trump that are all going to expire next year. They're going to expire in the year 2025. And so this Congress, once it's elected, is going to be empowered and given the responsibility of literally changing our tax code, of changing the structure for how we govern and putting in place the plan, hopefully to be able to shore up some of the most essential services they will offer to, in many cases, some of our most underserved and vulnerable parts of our population. So yes, this is going to be a very important election. Yes, it has the opportunity for chaos, but we the American people must get this right, because the future of our country really depends on this. And again, I'm not talking with me Democrat or Republican, because actually, you know, my favorite form of government is what they call divided government. you know, where neither Republicans nor Democrats can hold sway, because quite frankly, neither party has shown the ability, if they have full control, to govern effectively, to govern efficiently, and to address the problems. Everyone likes to talk about it, but we need to find a government that can pull together for the people of this country.
Amazing. David, you're such an intellect, and you always make me think critically, and I really appreciate that about you. Every time I encounter you, I learn something. And the last time you and I talked, you brought up something so unique that I have to talk about it now. You mentioned you wanted to, you think that we're in the fourth industrial revolution. And what do you mean by that? Fourth industrial revolution. What does that mean?
I tell you what, you talk about a time of exponential change. I truly think that we're in there now. So when we think of the term revolution, you know, we think about, you know, significant change. We think about a change that can have both winners and losers. Just like in a revolution, you have winners and losers. And we go all the way back from an economic standpoint, probably one of the most substantial changes really in the last 500 years was the first, what I would call the first industrial revolution, which was the invention of the steam engine. You think about it, back in the 1830s, you know, you had the invention by Robert Fulton of the steam engine. And what did that do? That changed fundamentally how we have transportation. It changes fundamentally, you know, the way that we gather our energy and the fact of what it created as a way of how we began to produce goods and services. And of course, it chose to be, or actually was, the end of the horse and buggy world in terms of transportation. But that was our first industrial revolution. That was the 1830s. Fast forward about 50 years. And you may have heard of a guy by the name of Henry Ford. Henry Ford, you know, obviously the inventor of Ford Motor Company, was really known for his invention of the assembly line, of automation. And this was, again, the second industrial revolution. Because not only did it allow us to, instead of make one car at a time, to be able to make 50 or 100 or 250 cars at the same time, it also signaled a transference of America from being a primarily rural, agrarian, farming economy into the emergence of people moving into the cities to be able to work in these factories. And certainly, you know, that's what Henry Ford did, but he created that engine for growth in that second industrial revolution. Now, the third one, we fast forward about 80 years from that to the 1960s. And that was really the invention of the computer, the microchip, you know, the semiconductor, and how we completely changed everything about the way that we operate, the way that we communicate, the way that that we engage with numbers and with data and information. And certainly the computer age, we know, has had incredible impact on our world. And you know, no longer do you see anybody walking around with a slide rule in their pocket, you know, and I remember when I was a kid in the 70s, you know, if you had a handheld calculator, you know, it weighed about 4 pounds and could basically do basic multiplication and addition. Now, you know, you can hold in your hands, in your smartphone, technology that would have filled an entire room in the 1960s, at much, much, much lower cost, obviously. But all of that, all of those industrial revolutions may pale in comparison to the fourth industrial revolution. And in fact, I will take an even bigger statement. I think that this is the most transformative time, will be the most transformative time since the Renaissance. Because what we're talking about here is the merging, the fusing together of the digital and the physical. And yes, what I'm talking about is artificial intelligence. So when we go forward, and what I believe is we are at the very beginning of this fourth industrial revolution, a revolution that will change everything, that we could see such quantum increases in our economy and our ability to grow our economy. And yes, there will be winners and there will be losers. You know, I believe the world will be divided into two types of people. Those who embrace the concept of artificial intelligence and can see the opportunity they had to propel them, to allow them to be more efficient, more effective. And those for whom artificial intelligence runs over, just like there have been winners and losers in every other environment. But the opportunity for what AI can and will do is truly exponential and even beyond that. And I know there's a lot of people who think, oh my gosh, is this something brand new? But you may not know this, Jen. You probably do. But our very first encounter with artificial intelligence actually occurred in the 1940s.
What?
And you think, 1940s, there was kind of a big thing going on called World War II. And the Germans had created this device called the Enigma device. And it allowed them to go out there and transmit messages, in a way that you couldn't break their code. And, all the best code breakers in the world could not never figure out, until there was a gentleman from Great Britain by the name of Alan Turing. And Alan Turing assembled some of the greatest minds in the world. And they created effectively the world's first thinking machine. And and they were able to break the code for the Enigma machine. And about 7 years later, 1950, Alan Turing actually set the standard for what he called the Turing test. And that really kind of the basis for what thinking machines should be all about. The very first chat box, believe it or not, was actually invented in 1964.
What?
And even far back as 1997, 27 years ago, there was a Russian chess champion, Garry Kasparov, that you may recall this, actually played a chess match. He was the world champion, and he played a chess match against an IBM computer called Deep Blue and lost.
And lost. I remember that.
but it's not just about some of those big dates. I mean, anyone who's walking around with a smartphone, the iPhone in 2008, had voice recognition software. Some of you may have in your home a Siri device. Some of you in your cars may have a device that tells you, oh, by the way, Jen, you are 4.5 miles from home. Some of you may have occasionally bought something on Amazon. And it says, oh, by the way, you might want to consider buying this. And so we have been surrounded by versions of artificial intelligence for decades. But what's happening and the exponential change that happened at the end of 2022 and throughout 2023 was the invention or the creation of something called generative AI. And generative AI is basically, whereas instead of artificial intelligence, these computers being able to take and assimilate all this data that you have put into the computer and all this out there in the cloud, and then give you, for lack of a better term, a supercharged Google search. Now what you're able to do is you're able to take that information, synthesize it, think through it, and then make their own determinations, and actually being able to then take that information and make decision making. It is the beginnings of trying to replicate human learning. And it's expected that sometime between the year 2030 and 2040, that there will be a computer developed that will be able to replicate the speed, the energy, the power of the human brain. And
wow.
So now, a lot of people, Jen, this freaks them out. This scares
No kidding.
And with good reason.
Right.
The way I think about AI is a little bit the same way I would think about a four-year-old preschooler. You think about a four-year-old preschooler, they have absolutely no idea about their own potential, their own capabilities. And quite frankly, they don't really have any moral or ethical code. So that they're just as capable of getting into mischief as they are doing good things. And so hopefully over time, you kind of mold that child so that they do have an ethical code and they do the right things. And AI is kind of like that right now. It can be involved in mischief. It can be involved in creating false news and, false celebrities and whatever else. But as we go forward, it'll be our challenge to take this immense and incredible tool and make it something that can be such an important gauge for productivity, for our economy. And let me tell you why this is so important. One of the things we talked about with the impact of the pandemic, and we're bringing it all back to the economy, is It took America from 1789, when our Constitution was, you know, was signed and we truly became a country, but all the way to 2020. It took all those years, 231 years, to build up to $20 trillion of debt. Now, we, as over time, you know, when our government had to borrow money, we had to do things like World War II, you know, when you had to fight and defend a war. And then we're able to pay some of it back. But the way that we've always paid our debt down, or at least brought it down as a percentage of our overall economy, was by growing our economy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, up until 1940, you know, our debt was about 10% of our overall economy. In the during World War II, it got to 42%. But it never got down below 10% after that. Well, over time, you know, now we've seen since COVID, where the level of debt has mushroomed, it's exploded from $20 trillion of debt in 2020 to $34 trillion just 4 years later. And because we have that debt, we have to make interest payments. Those people, you know, in the real estate world, you take on that mortgage, you've got to make those debt service payments. You got to make those interest payments. Well, just the interest on our debt alone this year is going to be nearly $1 trillion. $1 trillion. And our government only brings in about $4 trillion of revenue on a year. And oh, by the way, we're never going to pay down that $34 trillion of debt. It said that if a government really put their focus on trying to pay down their debt, it would take 30 years to pay down $1 trillion of debt. 30 years. We have $34 trillion. So what do you think the odds are that we're going to spend the next 1,020 years with a total focus on paying down debt? It's not going to happen.
Right.
But what could happen is to grow the economy enough so that we're building the overall level of goods and services that it's such that we can continue to support and manage that debt. But here's the problem. If we go back 15, 20 years ago, then government spending was about 9% of our overall economy. Today it's 25%. 25% out of every dollar that we spend in this economy is for paying for our government. And if you take a look at adding federal government, state government, and local government, it's 42%. And so when it's hard to grow an economy when you have a situation whereby that nearly half of your economy is not growing. Nearly half your economy is just redistributing money around to people who are needing those dollars. So this is why AI is so important, because if it can truly be that renaissance moment, that moment of true transformation, that can all of a sudden help our economy grow instead of at 1.5% per year, where it's been averaging, but to 6 or 7% per year, then we can grow the economy fast enough to overcome the mistakes that have been made and the debt that we've accumulated, and to actually continue to build service and provide the social support that we need in this country for our military, for our teachers, for our elderly, for our infirm, for those social services, and to be able to continue to be that dominant economy on the planet. And that's why AI, while it has its things that can scare us, it also can be that engine for growth that we're going to need as we go forward.
Wow. Well, between what's coming up in 2024 and looking even further into 2025, there's a lot of crazy things going on, my goodness. But let's zoom out a little bit and let's talk generationally. I know you and I have talked about the future and some of the next greatest issues, not including the debt, not including, you know, employment and housing and all the other known problems that we've got. What do you see as the greatest issue for the next generation?
There's a lot. I'm going to start with, again, the level of political divisiveness that we have here in the U.S. You know, we have got to find a way back to having a government that works and people that can talk to each other. The ability of people just have an intelligent debate has so far degraded over the past several years, that our political leaders are showing very little leadership and are building a nation that's all that's very polarized. That's an issue. And so because of the fact that we're not able to have the type of constructive dialogue, we're not able to really put our focus on a lot of these big issues that are out there. Issues such as climate change, issues such as the increasing inequality of wealth in our world and the income gap that exists. Issues such as rampant global poverty, issues such as food security, or for that matter, food insecurity, issues such as water shortages. You know, we had across major parts of the world this year and over the past 12 months, major issues with droughts. And I'm not just talking about in third world countries. I'm talking about here in the United States of America. So there are a number of enormous issues that we've got to confront. And, let's talk first about something like food insecurity. It's very difficult for a child to learn, to be able to develop the skills to accomplish their dreams if they're hungry. And we have, and just in the U.S., United States of America, we have 44 million Americans who don't have enough to eat. Wow. I'm not talking about going to a third world country. I'm talking about here in this country. And so, we have a shortage of housing. We have we have issues with our ability to effectively get food to those places where we need it. And again, these are things that are an outgrowth of some of the social struggles that we have and some of the poverty that's rampant. And as a result of those things, those then lead to other social issues such as crime and a mushrooming population that we have in our criminal justice system. So these are big issues, but we also have major issues when you think about a country like China, a country like Russia, that are continually more and more aggressive with military action. So we have a world that is unstable, and we have a world that needs a leader like the United States can be, but it's hard for us to lead if we can't even decide among ourselves, what are the most important issues? Where are we going? You've got obviously the huge debate that is climate change a real thing? Of course, climate change is a real thing. There's no question about that. The question is, what are the things that we should be doing to counteract that? What are the things that we should be doing to ensure that people can have adequate food, have appropriate shelter, can address these issues? In order to do that, we've got to move away from this period that we're in right now and try to find a way that we can communicate. And all this is going to be falling on the backs of this millennial generation. This millennial generation is 30% of the world's population, 30%. And yet they're facing, for the first time, as long as I can remember an ongoing study, a future that is far less certain and far less optimistic. And one of the things that has been a truly American, I think, trademark and psychological imperative is this belief that we can always do better than our parents. This belief that we can always build something greater. But yet we have an entire generation that feels that that is no longer a possibility, that we can no longer be there to solve the world's problems. And when you lose that sense of optimism, when you lose that sense of hope, then it creates even larger problems. So to me, when we think about the big issues, we think about poverty, we think about food insecurity, we think about climate change, we first have to think about how can we begin to come together as a people? How can we begin to move away from a period of polarization to a period of unity, to a period where we don't have to agree on every issue, but we can agree and embrace the fact that each of us has the right to our own opinion, but together we must come together to solve these big problems and to continue to have the type of society, the type of world that we want. Because in this world of great uncertainty, in this world of great turmoil, we need that optimism, we need that hopefulness, and we need that commitment to being problem solvers. And to me, ultimately, that's our biggest challenge, is to move from a world of limited opportunity to a world of limitless potential. And that, to me, has always been such an essential ingredient to being having that truly American point of view, and that idea that we're going to be part of the solution, and we're going to help lead towards finding that better tomorrow.
Amazing, amazing. Wow, David, you've gone through so much. Is there anything else that you can update us on?
Well, I'll just going back to the idea that we are talking about kind of an economic update. We kind of gone in some other areas. I do believe that we're going to be seeing a time over the course of the next couple of years where you're going to see mortgage rates continue to drop. We're going to see interest rates continue to drop. The Federal Reserve, as I mentioned, has short-term interest rates around 5.25% to 5.5%. They probably are going to cut interest rates probably three times this year. And over the next 2 to 3 years, we'll continue to cut interest rates as we bring that cost of money down to around 2.5% over the next 2 or 3 years. That will be very positive for the economy. I think we'll continue to see mortgage rates as they begin to decline. Again, we saw them peak around 8% last year. I think we probably will see them continue to drop throughout the most of this year. And I see mortgage rates a year from now probably in the mid to high fives, low 6% range. I do not anticipate us seeing interest rates going back down in those 2% and 3% ranges. And in fact, we don't want them to, because if we saw rates that low, that would indicate that something else really bad happened in the economy. Something really broke in our economy. But that should really, I think, spur a lot of more refinancing activity again, and certainly help provide for people who want to get into their first home the opportunity to do that. I still think, you know, we've got a major issue in this country with a supply-demand imbalance between the number of people looking to acquire that home and the number of homes that actually are available. Because we went through a period from 2008 to 2014 after the great financial crisis where banks, quite frankly, weren't lending money. They weren't lending money to builders, and they weren't lending money to first-time home buyers. And that put us behind the eight ball. And because we as a nation need to build about 1.5 to 2 million new homes every year just to keep up with the demand. So, but I do think that we will see more and more normalization of that, because homeowners ownership is such an incredibly important part of our overall economy. And I also believe that, again, inflation is going to continue to trend downward. Right now, we're at about 2.8% inflation. I think by the end of this year, we're going to be getting very close to that Fed target of 2%. So as we look forward, the longer-term economic outlook is very, very positive. And I certainly think that the fourth area that I'm tracking, which is earnings, profitability of corporate America and the global corporate world, then we went through a period of an economic trough last year. But we appear to be kind of beginning to come through that. And certainly by the time we get to the latter part of 2024, I think we're going to start seeing a period of economic earnings growth that's going to be very, very significant, that should, again, propel us through a period of lower interest rates, lower inflation, and good quality earnings growth that could set the stage, along with the exponential event of the continued evolution and growth of AI oriented businesses, you know, businesses like NVIDIA, businesses like Amazon, like Apple, like Meta, and many, many, many others that will be helping lead the way to what will be a bit of an uncertain future, but definitely a future of great potential and great opportunity as we continue to move into this fourth industrial revolution.
Love it. Oh, my goodness. Well, David, if the listeners want to learn more about you or they want to hire you as a financial consultant, of course, and many other items that you offer, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, first of all, they can always go to our website. You know, we're www.picklerwealthadvisors.com, and that's advisors with an O, not an E, picklerwealthadvisors.com. and certainly we're taking on new client relationships. You know, we believe that we have the most amazing opportunity on the planet, because it's our family delivering solutions for your family every single day. And we love solving problems for people. We love helping people plan for their future. But come to picklerwealthadvisors.com, and certainly we can connect you that way. We have clients all over the country and all over the world. And definitely would love to have a conversation with you if you think we can help you.
Awesome. David, as you might know, in all of my podcasts, I always have a call to action for my listeners. And actually today, because you are so dynamic, I have two calls to action. Okay, so listeners out there, here you go. Here's your homework. David is got one of the most dynamic podcasts out there. And if you want to hear more about David and David's team's insight, I highly recommend you listen to David's podcast, which is called The Bullcast. That's the item. That's action item number one for today. Go to The Bullcast on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. Do your search, whether it's Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever. Search for The Bullcast. And then your second call to action, David, tell us about your book.
Well, I tell you what, Jen, I kind of joke about this, that elephants are pregnant less long than it took me to write this book. this was a four-year labor of love, I've written a book called Pillars of Purpose, and it is a book about building a life of success and significance. And it's really all about how do you find your why? Mark Twain very famously stated that the two most important days in any person's life is the day they're born and the day they understand why. Mm-hmm. And so the first part of the book talks about uncovering your why. What is your passion? Understanding, the power of the possible and all the different things that come into finding out why you do what you do. Because remember, people do business with folks and they work with folks not because of what they do or who they are, but why they do. What is the motivation behind them? The second part of our book is all about the pillars. It's about the how. How can you actually build it? What are the steps that you can take to achieving your own life of success and significance? And then there's the third part. It's the glue that holds it all together, the accountability that you've got to have to hold yourself accountable to make sure that you are going to be pursuing those dreams, those opportunities. And then finally, we bring it all together with this whole conversation about success and significance. Now, I've always believed, while there are some people who are successful, but they never were really significant. They never really moved mm-hmm. the needle in their community or their world. But you've never met a person who was significant, who was not also successful. And so that's what this book is all about. It's about building your own personal journey, something that anyone can do. So check us out at pillarsofpurpose.com. And we actually will be launching our book on Amazon on April 18th. And would love to send you a copy.
Perfect. So that's the second call to action today is, so the first one's go to The Bullcast and the second one is check out pillarsofpurpose.com. David, thank you so much for joining us today. Oh my goodness. You're such a wealth of knowledge. Thank you.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Jen, and I thoroughly enjoy getting to know you and your family and certainly working with the amazing people with the Maui United Way. God bless you for the work that you're doing, the difference that I know that we're all trying to do together for the people of Maui and Lahaina, in the aftermath of the wildfires. But this has been an absolute joy and pleasure today. And thank you for giving me the honor. Truly the honor of being on your podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. Hey, for all you listeners out there, let me know your comments and questions. You can email me learn@mylifeasalandlord.com. Of course, comments and questions create the next podcasts and resources. Speaking of resources, I have a ton of resources on my website, mylifeasalandlord.com. Check them out. Thank you one more time to David Pickler. Join me next week for episode 68, where I actually explore the 2024 U.S. Rental Housing Report by Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies. I'll see you there.
Thanks for joining us this week. For all the show notes and resources, check out mylifeasalandlord.com. Want to invest further in your landlord education? We've got a toolbox for you, wherever you are in your journey. Make sure you follow the podcast on the platform you're listening on. Thank you again for joining me, Dr. Jennifer Salisbury, in this episode of My Life as a Landlord. I'll see you next time.